The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian. Actually, I'll be reading from Smithsonian.com because the magazine hasn't arrived yet. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We wish to thank them for their continued support. What you need to know about COVID masks in the age of Omicron. From what to wear to how to avoid counterfeits, experts weigh in on the latest advice about masks and COVID-19. By Emma, E-M-M-A, Yasinski, freelance writer. So she is. The story of the United States' evolving relationship with masks is a complicated one. When the pandemic started, Americans were told to save the masks for the healthcare workers. But before long, in April of 2020, that advice changed. The prevailing wisdom said to wear cloth masks, surgical masks, or even N95 masks if we could find them whenever we left our homes. If we couldn't get a mask, we could wear bandanas over our nose and mouth, anything to block viral particles from getting in or out of our noses and mouths, because scientists found that many individuals who were infected but didn't have symptoms were spreading the disease. At that point, many scientists believed that the virus was mostly spread via large droplets that quickly sank onto surfaces rather than hanging around in the air. In May of 2021, the Centers for Disease Control officially recognized that SARS-CoV-2 could linger in the air and spread via aerosolized transmission, which underscores the protective potential of covering your face. Still, the CDC generally recommended using whatever masks you could get your hands on, from a bandana to an N95. Many months later, in January, the CDC updated its mask guidance again for the public. It highlighted that people can choose to wear the most protective masks against COVID-19, N95s or KN95s, though it didn't specifically say not to wear the less protective surgical or cloth masks, even though they're known to be less protective. To find out what you should know about masks now at this stage of the nearly two-year-old pandemic, Smithsonian reached out to the experts to learn what works best and why. What does a mask do? Who does it protect? Masks are the most effective at preventing the person wearing them from spreading the virus to others, explains Sandra Bliss Nelson, an infectious disease specialist at Massachusetts General Hospital. But as we have gotten towards more transmissible variants with a higher prevalence of airborne spread, protecting the wearer has taken more priority. The idea, of course, is that masks filter the virus out of the air before that air is breathed in, which is especially important if the pathogen is believed to be aerosolized. Much of the research behind masking in healthcare comes from decades ago when tuberculosis outbreaks were common, explains Lisa Brosseau, a retired public health scientist, who consults for the University of Minnesota's Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Additionally, face masks increase humidity of the air that the wearer inhales. Richard Zare, a chemist at Stanford University, and his team have found that the increased moisture may play a role in decreasing the risk of exposure because water droplets start to produce the disinfectant, hydrogen peroxide, which can neutralize the virus when relative humidity climbs above 40%. In this increasingly muggy environment, the droplets that carry the virus collect water and grow larger, and droplets of a certain size kill viruses and bacteria, says Zare. Masks do much more than filter out the virus. In April of 2020, a COVID-19 outbreak hit service members aboard the USS Theodore Roosevelt. Those crew members, who self-reported wearing masks, had 55.8% chance of being infected, whereas those who didn't had about an 80% chance of getting COVID-19. But one of the most convincing studies on the ability of masks to limit spread of COVID-19 was conducted on 600 villages in rural Bangladesh. For the study, published this past December in Science, entire villages were randomized to receive free cloth masks, surgical masks, or no masks, along with education about and reminders to wear them, such as signs in public places. Overall, the study included 350,000 people. In villages where scientists promoted mask wearing, 42% of residents wore them in public, compared to only 13% in the other villages. Those villages with more masking had 9.5% fewer symptomatic COVID-19 cases than their barefaced counterparts. That was really the first powerful evidence that masks work to prevent COVID-19, says Nelson. The authors of the study emphasized that while a 9.5% difference may not sound like a lot, if more stringent controls like masks mandates caused more than 42% of people to mask up, the number of cases avoided might be much higher. What is the difference between N95, surgical, and cloth masks? Not all masks are created equal. In fact, in the study of Bangladesh villages, surgical masks were associated with an 11% drop of infections, whereas cloth masks only reduced infections by 5%. All masks are designed to block viral particles from getting through, but some do so better than others. N95, KN95, KF94, and surgical masks are all made with cloth that have an electrostatic charge. This charge attracts the viral particles, so they get stuck in the fabric and don't get through to your nose or mouth. The charge offers one more layer of protection that the strictly physical barrier of cloth masks doesn't provide. If properly fitted, an N95, KN95 or KF94 should filter 94% to 95% of viral particles. Despite quality filters, surgical masks are often less effective because they aren't designed to create a seal on your face, meaning the virus can easily slip through gaps. Healthcare professionals are required to have a fit test to make sure their N95 masks are properly sealed and don't leak. But for the rest of us, one of the easiest ways to tell, says Nelson, is you can actually see the mask's indent as you breathe. That suggests you have a good fit. She adds that for individuals who wear glasses, like I do, you can see if your glasses are fogging up. That means air is escaping out at the top, and your mask is not perfectly sealed. In March 2021, Smithsonian ran an article about how to make your own masks. It recommended using 100% cotton flannel and inserting a filter, HEPA if you have it, or a coffee filter. And research has shown that these masks can block droplets more effectively than bandanas or cloth masks with a single layer. Since there's no longer a shortage of surgical or N95 masks, Brosseau says making your own mask is no longer a good option at all. How to avoid counterfeits? N95s, KN95s, and KF94s are slightly different in terms of shape and style, but all use high-quality material that filters 94% to 95% of the virus. Each type is regulated and certified in a different country. N95s are regulated by the United States National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. The KN95 is designed to meet Chinese standards, and the KF94 adheres to Korean regulations. Unfortunately, no N95s are made specifically for children, but KN95s and KF94s do exist for kids. They still require the same level or approval as other masks. Throughout the pandemic, some manufacturers have added misleading words and logos to their labels to make the mask seem like they've been inspected and approved, even if they aren't certified. NIOSH provides some examples of counterfeit masks here and a list of approved N95s here. The FDA also has two lists of KN95 masks that were authorized for healthcare workers during the shortage of N95s. You can also look at an infographic from CDC that describes the information you should be able to find right on the front of any legitimate N95 mask. Similarly, you should see the name of the manufacturer, model, and GB number on the front of a KN95 mask. The KF94s don't have text on the front, but should be made in Korea. Another option is ordering vetted masks through the nonprofit website Project N95 instead of suppliers like Amazon that may harbor counterfeits alongside certified masks. How long can you wear masks and should you wash them? If you're a healthcare worker or someone who is regularly exposed to high levels of SARS-CoV-2, you might consider some of the strategies laid out in a New York Times article to reuse your masks. For example, experts suggest with proper care, a mask can be worn up to 40 hours. For the rest of us, Nelson says that most of the public isn't exposed to that much virus. So I tell people you wear it until it feels grungy, or it just feels like it's not really fitting well anymore, she says. But at that point, it's time to just replace the mask, not wash it. You can't put them in the microwave. You can't put them in water. Moving on, under Smart News, in a day-long protest, Dutch museums transform into gyms, nail salons, and barbershops. The coordinated effort was playful, but challenged the government's inconsistent COVID-19 lockdown measures, by Nora McGreevy, Daily Correspondent. Last Wednesday, more than 70 museums and cultural institutions in the Netherlands temporarily reopened their storied galleries as makeshift nail salons, barbershops, and gyms. Organizers of the coordinated event described it as a lighthearted protest of the government's inconsistent COVID-19 restrictions. Under the rules, theaters, bars, cafes, and museums must remain shuttered, while hair and nail salons and gyms are permitted to open, reports Anna Holligan for BBC News. Cultural institutions and venues have been closed since the country entered a national lockdown in December, in response to a surge in the COVID-19 pandemic attributed to the fast-spreading Omicron variant. Even as infection case numbers reached record highs, the Dutch government relaxed some of its lockdown restrictions last week as hospitalizations fell, reopening non-essential shops until 5 p.m., as well as gyms, hairdressers, nail salons, and brothels, reports Claire Moses for the New York Times. The art sector, still restricted from opening to the public, responded with a coordinated act of civil disobedience. At the Van Gogh Museum, manicurists created nail designs inspired by the Impressionist painter's flowering trees and Starry Night Skies. At Amsterdam's Royal Concert Hall, barbers offered haircuts during orchestra rehearsals, per BBC News. Meanwhile, patrons of the Amsterdam Museum rolled out yoga mats next to priceless paintings, while actors performed plays in the hallways, reports Tessa Solomon for Art News. Performance artists Sane Wallace de Veers and Diedrich Ebenage organized the protest. On the event's website, they billed the day-long event as a playful initiative to draw attention to the dire situation in the cultural sector. Some institutions chose not to participate after local officials threatened fines, reports the Post. And while some 30 mayors across the country expressed support for the cause, others, such as Amsterdam Mayor Femke Halsema, stated that she would not permit the protests to occur, according to the New York Times. Despite the mayor's statements, Amelie Gordennecker, the director of the Van Gogh Museum, decided to go through with the planned event, according to BBC News. A museum visit is a safe visit, and equally important as going to a nail salon, perhaps more so, she says. We just ask them to be consistent, make the rules in a way everyone understands them. At this point, that seems to be lacking. By Nora McGreevy. She's a daily correspondent for Smithsonian. She is also a freelance journalist based in Chicago, whose work has appeared in Wired, Washington, the Boston Globe, South Bend Tribune, and the New York Times, and more. Up next, the first woman commander of the U.S. Navy's oldest ship takes the helm. Billy Farrell is the new captain of the USS Constitution, a 1797 frigate that now serves as a floating museum, by David Kindy, daily correspondent. For the first time in its 224-year history, the USS Constitution has a woman captain. Billy J. Farrell, 39, is the 77th commanding officer of the United States Navy's oldest commissioned warship, also known as Old Ironsides. Her appointment took place during an official ceremony in Boston on January 21, reports Matt Yon for the Boston Globe. Farrell relieved John Benda, who'd served as the ship's captain since February 2020. To be the captain of the ship and have ties to the heritage of our Navy and our country is just an unbelievable experience, Farrell tells Veronica Stakalursi of CNN. And to be the first woman to do it, also special because there are so many women serving our country right now, and so I get a chance to represent them. According to her Navy biography, the career officer graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 2004. She previously served as the executive officer aboard the Ticonderoga-class guided missile cruiser USS Vicksburg. Farrell has received numerous decorations for her service, including two Meritorious Service Medals, four Navy and Marine Corps Commendation Medals, and three Meritorious Unit Commendations. This is just a great opportunity to again tie back to the heritage of where our Navy started, to bring the modern and the historic together and bridge that and serve as a representative to share that story, Farrell tells Rupa Shenoy of WBUR's Morning Edition. A native of Paducah, Kentucky, Farrell became interested in serving in the Navy while in sixth grade. After watching a televised Naval Academy graduation, I immediately told my parents that's where I was going to go to school. Immediately drawn to the traditions and the kind of customs and everything that I saw on TV, she says to WBUR. According to a Navy statement, the Constitution was launched in 1797 and played a crucial role in both the Barbary Wars and the War of 1812. The three-masted wooden frigate went undefeated in battle and captured 33 enemy vessels during its decades at sea. It was retired from active service in 1881 and designated as a floating museum in 1907, wrote Dan LaMoth of the Washington Post in 2015. The vessel earned its nickname during the War of 1812, when British cannonballs bounced off the ship's hull, which reacted as if it were made out of iron rather than wood. Oliver Wendell Holmes, Sr.'s Oliver Wendell Holmes, Sr.'s 1830 poem, Old Ironsides, quickly immortalized the Constitution in popular imagination. The ship received its first woman crew member, enlisted sailor Rosemarie Lanham, in 1986, notes the Navy statement. A decade later, Lieutenant Commander Claire V. Bloom joined the crew as the vessel's first woman commissioned officer. Bloom led the ship's historic 1997 cruise, the first time out to sea since docking in 1881. Today, women make up more than one-third of the Constitution's 80-person crew. In videos posted on social media by the USS Constitution Museum, both Bloom and Lanham congratulated Farrell. The ship is permanently berthed at the museum in Charlestown Navy Yard, a National Historic Park in Boston. Every year, on July 4th, the Constitution unfurls its sails and leaves port under its own power. The crew celebrates Independence Day by firing a 21-gun salute in Boston Harbor. Upon the sailors' return, they turn the vessel around so it can weather evenly on both sides of its hull. Farrell tells WBUR that she is looking forward to leading Old Ironsides' annual cruise. I'm just super excited to be here and to get the opportunity to serve as the commanding officer of USS Constitution, she says. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. There's only 76 other people in history that have had the job, and I'm just so thrilled to be here. That's by David Kindy. David Kindy is a daily correspondent for Smithsonian. He's also a journalist, freelance writer, and book reviewer who lives in Plymouth, Massachusetts. He writes about history, culture, and other topics for Air and Space, military history, World War II, Vietnam, aviation history, Providence Journal, and other publications and websites. And for our final story, meet the trailblazers in women's Olympic snowboarding. The careers of Shannon Dunn Downing, Kelly Clark, Amy Purdy, and Hannah Teeter are recognized in the Smithsonian Collection. And when the women of the U.S. snowboard team, including prior gold medalist Chloe Kim, hit the slopes for the Olympic Games in Beijing this week, they will be following in the grooves laid down by dozens of women who came before them. These are the athletes who carved out their own achievements and identities in a sport that many might only associate with male aggression. Snowboarding got its start around the mid-1960s after Sherman Poppin introduced his snurfer, consisting of two skis cobbled together that allowed someone to ride surfer style down the slopes. Beijing Winter Olympic 2022. This was no single-gendered sport. Boys and girls were both attracted to the excitement of the new and different activity. This seemed more like a fun thing to do than a sport to excel in. As snowboarding gained more followers in the 1980s and 1990s, enthusiasts were viewed as disruptors and were usually not welcome on ski mountains. They carved huge paths back and forth across groomed slopes where skiers were trying to quietly shush and try to catch air off bumps and land with thuds on their backsides. It was as if the largely testosterone-fueled skateboard culture had come to the mountains. When the first professional snowboarding event, the U.S. Open, was held in 1982 in Vermont, it featured only men, And initially, at least, the contest aped skiing with downhill and slalom events. But just 2 years later, the first women would join the event in the half-pipe contest, which involves boarding back and forth to get up the walls, executing tricks at the top, and has come to be most closely associated with snowboarding, was added. The sponsor, snowboarding pioneer Jake Burton, decided to offer equal prize money from the start. Four female pioneers, Shannon Dundowning, Kelly Clark, Amy Purdy, and Hannah Teeter, now have their career accolades preserved at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. All have donated gear or clothing to the museum, most of it from their Olympics participation. None are currently on display, but maybe at some point, says curator Jane Rogers, a scholar in the history of American sport. Rogers, who urged the women to make these donations, got interested in snowboarding's lively history a decade ago and has been trying to add to the collections ever since. She sees the sport as quintessentially American. Americans are always kind of the outsider, she says. Collecting ephemera from snowboarding is a natural for the museum because it really shows how our culture is progressing and experimenting and innovating in sports, she says. Recognition of female athletes is critical to the history, Rogers says. Among the items held in the collection are Dundowning's jacket and pants that she wore in the 1998 games in Nagano, Japan, and an outfit from the 2002 Salt Lake City Olympics where she placed fifth in the halfpipe as her pro career was coming to an end. Clark Burton's feel-good snowboard she used at the 2014 Sochi Winter Olympics where she won bronze. Tedder's boots from the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics where she won silver. Purdy's race bib and a synthetic metal foot prosthetic she used at the Sochi Paralympics, along with medals won in 2013 at the Europa Cup Snowboard Cross Championships and the IPC Snowboard Cross World Cup, as well as a trophy from the 2013 IPC Para Snowboard World Cup. Three of the four women spoke with the Smithsonian about their experiences growing up around and evolving with the sport. Shannon Dundowning, 49, is the first ever American Olympic snowboarding medalist, male or female, from her home in San Diego. She recalls snowboarding's early days. And that's our cue to wrap it up. We almost got it all read. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian.com. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen, and we thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. So long.